I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. We were sad to learn that famed primatologist, biologist, and author Franz de Waal had died last week. He was 75 years old and had a long association with Emory University and the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. I had the pleasure of interviewing him on several of his books when I hosted Radio Times. I found our conversation stimulating, provocative, exploring the connections between humans and our evolutionary ancestors, involving things like intelligence, morality, culture, and emotions. Today we play highlights from three of those conversations, including his views on gender and the animal mind. We begin with de Waal's 2013 book, The Bonobo and the Atheist, in which he argued that morality doesn't come from a top-down God. Rather, it's a bottom-up process built into our species. We started with a discussion about chimps and bonobos. Your book is largely about the research on chimpanzees and bonobos, our closest living relatives, but they're different. I mean, these two species, they're different from each other.
These two are very different. So anthropologists have always preferred the chimpanzee to compare us with, because chimpanzees are aggressive and wage war, and the males kill males in other territories, and they have strong hierarchies. And for some reason, this was very popular, because, of course, anthropologists believe that humans advanced as a species by wiping out everybody else. That's actually a problematic proposition, because we now know that humans have 4% DNA of our DNA is Neanderthal DNA, which means that instead of wiping out the Neanderthals, we bred with them. And so sex was part of the story. They don't like the bonobo for the reason that the bonobo is not aggressive, has a lot of sex. And my view is that maybe our history has more bonobo elements than they want to admit, and less chimpanzee elements of violence and so on.
So should we think of bonobos as hippies?
Yeah, they are sort of
the 60s.
They are sort of the hippies of the primate world, because they have female dominance. So they're very popular with the feminist community for that reason. They have lots of sex in all sorts of combinations, so they're very popular with the gay community for that reason. So they are sort of the politically correct primate. But the reason they have so much sex is probably partly to keep the aggression under control, and they're very good at it.
So what you actually have in the beginning of the book, a description. These are chimps, actually. A chimp, one called Daisy, one called Amos. Amos is seriously ill. But you observe and write about something that the Daisy does, and perhaps this helps us understand what empathy might look like, at least coming from a chimpanzee.
So Amos was a very popular male with the chimpanzees, also very popular with us, actually. He was a beautiful male, but he got terribly ill, and he was sitting in a caged area, whereas all the other chimps were outdoors and outside. But we had cracked the door to his area so that other chimps could access him. And Daisy, who's a good friend of his, female, she would come over and stroke him and groom him, and he would lean to the crack of the door to have her do that. But at some point, she started shoving wood wool towards him, which the chimps used to build nests and to sleep on. And he was not accepting it. And so she started pushing the wool behind his back, between his back and the wall. And very much, it looked very much like the way humans put pillows behind a patient who is in the hospital to make them comfortable. And since Daisy herself is a big woodwool user herself, she loves that stuff, she must have been imagining how he would feel if he could lean back against that stuff. And so she was doing that. And that made me think of perspective taking, because empathy in general, of being sensitive to the emotions of others and caring for others, is not uniquely primate. But taking the perspective of somebody else, sort of understanding how someone might feel under certain circumstances, that gets us close to human kind of empathy.
Well, it raises questions about identity. You know, who am I, and who are you? About attachment, about what it is to feel for someone else, and this notion that I am. I won't say somebody. I don't know if I can say that, but that I exist separate from you.
Yeah, so children, for example, when they reach the age of mirror self-recognition, they start to recognize themselves in the mirror, that's the age where their empathy becomes more complex, because at that point they can draw a line between themselves and the other. So instead of fusing with the other, and if you're crying, I'm crying, like babies do that already, which is a very simple form of empathy, they start now to draw a line between themselves and the other, which allows them to take the perspective of somebody else. And there are a few animals, of course, who can recognize themselves in mirrors. We have done ourselves the elephant mirror test. Chimpanzees can do it, bonobos can do it, humans can do it after a certain age. And so the species who can recognize themselves in the mirror, they usually have more complex forms of empathy.
You've also done some interesting research, I guess, on this notion of fairness. A bonobo, Panbashiba, did I say that name right?
Panbanisha.
Showed a kind of generosity, I guess, in dealing with treats that she was getting.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's purely generosity. What happened in that case, she was being trained for a certain task and getting lots of goodies for it, like M&Ms and raisins and good stuff that the bonobos usually don't get. And other bonobos were watching her from a distance that she normally lives with. And at some point, she stopped doing the task and she waved her hand to the others until the others also got some of the goodies, and then she continued. And so, yes, you could look at it as an act of generosity. You could also look at it, well, she might get into trouble later on. If she takes all this good stuff and they get nothing, and then later we reunite to bonobos, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And that's actually, fairness is an interesting concept, because I think fairness is not necessarily regulated by empathy. It's regulated by having good relationships, and if you have a fair distribution, it's easier to maintain them than if you have an unfair distribution.
And because I called it generosity, are there also risks of ascribing certain traits that we would think of as human traits to, in this case, to primates?
Well, I tend to take the position that if an animal is very closely related to us and does similar things under similar circumstances, we have to come up with a similar concept to explain it. So I know that there are psychologists and people who work on animals who are very conservative in their terminology and say we should avoid anthropomorphism, which is fine if you see, for example, fish doing something similar to humans. Yes, there's probably a different explanation for what the fish are doing. But a chimpanzee or bonobo is as close to us genetically as a horse is to a zebra. Now, if a horse and a zebra do similar stuff under similar circumstances, we're certainly going to come up with a similar explanation for it. And I would apply the same rule to human and primate behavior.
So can we say that the chimps and bonobos, that they're moral creatures?
I wouldn't call them moral. And I've never called a chimpanzee or bonobo a moral being in the human sense. I think they have a lot of the ingredients that we have built into our moral system, such as caring about others, caring about rules, following rules, punishing those who deviate. All these things can be observed in them, empathy, sense of fairness, and so on. But to have real morality the way we do, there's additional elements. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we reason about and we try to justify why we have certain rules. And we try to seek consistency. We have a discussion about whether if you're for the death penalty, you should be for abortion, or the kind of discussions we have. And so that sort of thing, of course, doesn't happen really in chimpanzees and bonobos. And we also try to objectify these rules. And so the moral rules that we live by, we, for example, I live by, you live by, we feel everyone in the world should live by these rules. And so we think that the rules are universal, and I don't think chimpanzees particularly care about that issue.
At least not yet in their evolution. But it also seems, and you had mentioned philosophers earlier on, that not that you're challenging this notion about the sort of logic of ethical or moral behavior, but saying it's so much more than that, that we have to include biology when we understand about ethical moral behavior.
Yeah, so what happened is that at first moral rules came from God and came from religion. And then after the Enlightenment, the philosophers said, no, we don't necessarily need God, but it comes from reason and logic. And so the philosophers had a prominent place in providing this reason and logic. But it's still a top-down view of morality where you say, humans don't really know how to behave. Someone ought to tell them how to behave. If it's not to the religious leaders, it's going to be the philosophers who's going to tell them. But I'm much more of the school, which is very popular at the moment among neuroscientists and biologists, of a bottom-up view of morality, where we say morality comes out of interactions and social tendencies between people, sort of consensus building among people of how we should behave. and the top-down normative features of morality, which do exist, they come sort of secondarily. Yeah.
Yeah. But are you also saying, I mean, there is this, and you write about it in the book, this veneer theory of morality, the idea that underneath us we're just wild, you know, a cauldron of nasty tendencies. I think I'm quoting you there. That's a view of human nature, is that we're essentially bad, mm-hmm. And we have this overlay of morality that forces us to be good.
That's a view that was actually popular in biology. It was not a Darwinian view, but during the 70s and 80s and 90s, biologists such as Richard Dawkins and Robert Wright and other people, they started promoting this view that we are inherently selfish and competitive, and there's really no room for moral evolution. Just like Huxley, who was a contemporary of Darwin, who also saw no room for the evolution of morality, the biologists sort of talked us into this corner where, on the one hand, they said evolution cannot explain morality, we don't believe in religion. Well, then there's nothing left. If biology and religion are not there, then I don't know how you would ever explain the reason we have morality. And so Darwin saw this problem, recognized this, and Darwin proposed that evolution can produce these moral tendencies. Now, the veneer theory is basically the idea that we are so 100% selfish that we can never overcome that, maybe only culturally or religiously, and that we naturally don't have any tendency to be good or nice to others. Mm. Now, this whole thing is now sort of forgotten, because after the year 2000, the economists started to find that we are much more cooperative than they thought. Then the neuroscientists found that if we give to charity and do nice things, there's pleasure centers in our brain that light up, meaning that we take pleasure in being nice to other people. Then primatologists such as myself said, well, a lot of our close relatives, they have actually genuine altruism going on. And the anthropologists started playing the ultimatum game all over the world and finding sense of fairness in all people of the world. Around the year 2000, the whole veneer theory collapsed and is now nearly forgotten 10 years later.
Your book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist. Mm-hmm. And you have at the very end, essentially, what would a bonobo tell an atheist? Expand on that. I found that an interesting section.
And actually, in that discussion that I put at the end between the bonobo and the atheist, the bonobo grants a lot of ground to the atheist.
He's very nice to the atheist.
Yeah, he's actually very nice to the atheist. And so I don't think atheists should be too upset with my book. But the bonobo basically says, slow down on that question of whether God exists or not. That is not really the interesting question. He says the interesting question is, where does morality come from? And then, of course, the bonobo also explains that we shouldn't look too much at social insects, which has been done so much, but they don't have the empathy mechanism. They have lots of altruism, which is probably achieved in a different way. Mm-hmm. So I'm not denying that they are not they're perfectly cooperative and altruistic, but they don't have that empathy mechanism that makes you respond to the distress of others that all the mammals have. And so that's what the bonobo tries to explain about it.
That was biologist Frans de Waal from a 2013 interview about his book, The Bonobo and the Atheist. De Waal died last week, and we're playing highlights of my interviews with him because he has a lot to say about the connections we have with our primate cousins. Coming up, what his research reveals about gender. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to The Connection here on WHYY. And today on the show, we are featuring highlights of some of my interviews with acclaimed biologist Frans de Waal, who died last week. I had the pleasure of interviewing him on Radio Times, and what he had to say about what us primates have in common fits very nicely into the conversations we have on The Connection. I spoke with him 2 years ago about his book Different, Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. It was about the diversity he found in the primate world and how it can help us understand and embrace diversity in our own species. He challenged many of the widely held assumptions about nature nurture, power leadership, competition, cooperation, and sexual behavior. We began where the first interview began, with chimps and bonobos, because they can tell us so much about us. You have spent decades studying chimps and bonobos, first chimps and then bonobos. Mm-hmm. Help us understand, I guess, what these two parts of our family have in common, and then we'll talk about their differences.
Yeah, so that's so interesting. We have two close relatives. People always compare us with chimpanzees, which is fine. They are close relatives. But the bonobos are equally close. And chimpanzees are fairly aggressive, violent, male-dominated. Bonobos are peaceful, sexy, female-dominated. So if you make the comparison, it immediately becomes a complexity. Like, you know, people who say, for example, it's natural that males are dominant, then I would say, well, you know, our close relatives don't necessarily agree with that all the time. So I think that triangular comparison is central to my book, of course. I talk a lot about humans, but also about our two close relatives. And it is more complex than people think.
When you say bonobos are sexy, what does that mean?
They have a lot of sexual activity in all combinations of individuals. I would not even call them homosexual or heterosexual. I think they're completely bisexual. They don't particularly care.
Omnisexual in a way?
Omni, yeah. Omnisexual or pansexual, we call it sometimes. So bonobos have all combinations, all sorts of positions, even positions that people cannot imagine, like they can do it hanging upside down by their feet or something, you know. They can do all sorts of things. And they have that sexual activity largely for social purposes. And that's why if you say that sex in animals is for breeding, I would say in the bonobo that's not necessarily the case. I think 3/4 of their sexual activity has nothing to do with reproduction.
Yeah. In fact, you and others call them the hippies of the world. For that very reason.
They're pleasure seekers also. For example, the female clitoris is the largest clitoris in the primate world, larger than in humans also. So they're pleasure seekers. But also it's important socially for them. For example, there's a lot of sex between females, and the females need to bond. The females dominate the males collectively, not individually. The female bonobo is smaller than the male. So collectively they dominate the males, and in order to do so they have to have strong bonding and sisterhood, and that's how it is. It is serviced by grooming and sex.
And then I'm thinking conversely then, so being a female chimp, what you say is a more male-dominated family.
Yeah, since chimps are more violent.
And they truly are, correct?
So bonobos don't kill each other. We don't have actual observations of one bonobo killing another one. So, but chimps do. There's quite a bit of evidence that chimps do between groups, but also sometimes within groups. And so females, the male dominance is not very gentle. And so females have a rough life, I think, in chimpanzee society.
You write about a chimp, Luit?
Yeah.
L-U-I-T?
Luit, yeah.
Luit. Who was beat up by other chimps. I mean, beat up is maybe not the correct word.
Killed. He was killed by two other males. Yeah.
Based on what caused that? And what does that tell us?
That's the dominant struggles among male chimps. Male chimps take that very seriously, and the whole day they're busy politicking and making coalitions. And I wrote a book, Chimpanzee Politics, which was my first book on these shenanigans of the male chimpanzees. And sometimes it turns violent. Most of the time, actually, I would say 90% of the time, they handle it without necessarily physical fights. So there's a lot of maneuvering going on. But sometimes it escalates. And in his case, he got killed by two other males.
Do we know what for? What he was killed for?
He rose to power because the existing coalition between two males fell apart. And as soon as it fell apart, he became the dominant male because they kept him under control together. And I think these two males were so extremely frustrated that they had lost their power that a couple of weeks later they got him, yeah.
Can we extrapolate then from bonobos and chimpanzees to then humans and violence and aggression?
Well, clearly that's a big gender difference in the human species is that you look at all the homicide statistics of any country, you're going to find more men committing homicides than women. So that is universal in the human species, and it's universal in the primates, is that the males are more physically violent than the female. I'm not saying that the females are not competitive or don't fight. Females are perfectly capable of all of that, but the killing part, that's a male thing. And so, that's one of the major differences that we see everywhere. And people can say it's due to socialization or something like that, but I don't believe that would work over the whole world for all humans everywhere, you know.
You think it's something more hardwired or
part of this? That's a biological tendency, and we see that in the animal kingdom everywhere. We see males being more physically violent. Yeah.
Do you see then females as a kind of moderating influence within that world? Do they play that role?
Females can play that role among males. The females among themselves can be sometimes pretty nasty.
I can attest to that.
and competitive. So to depict females as sort of angels doesn't sit well with me, because I see a lot of female competition. But the physical violence, that's more a male thing. And it's very hard to get rid of that. But I think it culturally, we can certainly suppress it. I think we have so many possibilities culturally to modify behavior. So I think we can encourage it or we can suppress it among the men.
A caller couldn't stay on the line, but he wanted to speak to what females can do to have more authority. And that's just really picking up on what you and I were talking about bonobos and chimps. Can we expand on that?
Yeah, so I think you need to make a distinction in the primate world, but also in the human world, between physical dominance and power. So physically, the males are bigger and stronger, and physically they dominate females in most cases, except in the bonobo. But power can be in the hands of females very clearly. Females have a hierarchy. The females are very hierarchical, also in our species. I know that people sometimes deny that, but I think our species is also very hierarchical. And you know, the word pecking order comes from hens, not from roosters. And so female hierarchies are very well known in the animal kingdom. And the top female, we call the alpha female. There's always an alpha female in a primate group, and the alpha female can have enormous power. So, for example, In bonobos, this is obvious because the alpha female is alpha over everyone, including the males. But even in chimpanzees, my previous book was about Mama, the chimpanzee, who for 40 years was alpha female. The males, there was no male who could become an alpha male without her support. So she sort of picked which male was going to be the alpha male. So that already shows a little bit of power right there. She decided a lot of group processes. And since she was for such a long time in that position, the males came and went, so to speak, during that time. So I think female leadership is easy to find in the primate world. It's really not hard to look for it. And sometimes these females have an enormous influence. And so if you ask, can females be leaders, I don't see any limitation from the primate perspective in that regard.
And certainly you can look at the human world and see many, many women who are in positions of authority. You mentioned alpha females and also alpha males. Mm-hmm. We use that phrase, I think, in a kind of negative way when talking about alpha males in the workplace and they're bullying and they're difficult to deal with. You're saying that really doesn't tell the whole picture. When we talk about alpha males, it includes a lot of qualities.
I find that very unfortunate, because when I wrote Chimpanzee Politics, I used the word alpha male, and the politicians in Washington, they picked that up, that term, from my chimpanzee work, and started using it, and then the business world started using it in a negative way. Like, he's a real alpha male. He can beat up anyone and no one will notice. The bullying type. And they do exist in the primate world. We do sometimes have alpha males who terrorize everybody. But we also have many males who have leadership capacities, who keep order. They defend the underdog. They show empathy for others. They protect the group. And that kind of males, many of them, they can become extremely popular. And so I've known alpha males who, when they finally lost their position and became older males in the group, they became extremely popular. So they, long after their position, they still remain popular. And bullies, males who bully everybody, when they lose their position, we in captivity, we sometimes have to remove them because they are in trouble and they may get killed. And in the field, they sometimes get marginalized. They live on the edges edges of the territory because they are not accepted so much in the group. So being a bully in the short run may pay off, I don't know, but in the long run, I don't think it's the best possible strategy.
And I'm extrapolating to the human world based on what you just said there. I mean, I'm thinking, again, sort of broadly speaking, that the boys roughhouse, girls, you know, carry around dolls and teddy bears. And some people object to that, thinking, you know, we're forcing these stereotypes on children.
Yeah, that's what people say. The people call it stereotypes. But actually, the interest in dolls and infants in young females is, I think it's not a stereotype. It's typical for the young females. So, for example, young primate females, they, as soon as there's a mother with a newborn, they surround her. They hang out with her. They try to get their hands on the baby. They want to hold the baby. When they're inexperienced, the mother usually is very reluctant to give them the baby, of course. But when they are more experienced, they become the babysitters. The mothers will trust them with their baby. And young males are usually not present in that crowd. They're not particularly interested in these things. In the wild, we've also seen female chimps, young female chimps, using logs and rocks as a sort of doll. They carry it on their back or they carry it on their belly. They build nests for them. So they make dolls out of nothing, like human girls can do that too. And so I think the interest in infants and dolls is something that we see in many female primates.
And I wonder too about, you know, then the ability of, and I'm feeling like the words masculine and feminine don't apply in our conversation, but nonetheless, let's say a father can be a nurturing parent, right?
Yeah, that's another misconception that people have, is that nurturing kids is not something for the males. And I've even heard conservative radio shows making fun of paternity leave. Why would you need paternity leave? It's the man who don't take care of the kids, you know. I think that's nonsense. And even in chimps and bonobos, where the males normally do very, very little, apart from protecting, they do very little with the young ones. If there is an orphan, if a mother dies, and all of a sudden there's an orphan who's calling out for help, it's very often adult males who adopt them. And not just for 2 days, they adopt them sometimes for many years, and they carry them on their back, and they take care of them, and they wait for them when they travel, and they protect them. So caring for kids is something that the males can do, and they have a tendency to do if it's necessary. And that's in our close relatives. I think humans are even more prone to do that because we evolved nuclear families where males are involved in the care of a family. And so I think we are even more prone to do that.
Well, let me quote Kinsey, who you quote in your book, and a couple of sentences here. He writes, males do not represent two discrete populations, heterosexual and homosexual. The world is not to be divided into sheep and goats. Not all things are black, nor all things white. It is a fundamental of taxonomy, that nature rarely deals with discrete categories. Only the human mind invents categories and tries to force facts into separated pigeonholes. I circled that and underscored that because I thought that was so important. I mean, he was studying human sexuality and came to this conclusion.
It's funny that he mentioned sheep in that,
he does, sheep
in
and
that
goats.
Story, because now we have evidence. Most of the time we say homosexual behavior is found in the animal kingdom, and the primates show a lot of homosexual behavior, but you don't find exclusive homosexuality usually. But sheep are an exception. So rams and ewes, is that the word?
Ewes.
Okay. Rams and ewes. In the rams, we find, I believe, 10 to 12% of the males is very focused on other males sexually, much more than on females. And so he mentioned sheep without knowing that in the end we have now studies showing that there's quite a bit of homosexual behavior there.
Yeah, he was quite a visionary. But this impulse, this human impulse to think of the world divided into these two binaries, I mean, is there an explanation for that?
Well, we are a symbolic species, so we label. We love to label. And the primates don't have that tendency. And so you don't need to fit in a box necessarily. And in the primates, the interesting thing to me is that we see quite a bit of this gender variability. So we see also, for example, males who don't play the macho game and don't want to become the dominant male and stay out of all these confrontations. So we have quite a bit of variability, but I never noticed that that there is intolerance to that. It's not as if the others are upset by that. That's just how that individual is, and they deal with it, you know?
Let me read a tweet from Joan. Cross-cultural variation exists in terms of gender categories. A few cultures have three or four categories. Not all cultures categorize gender into only binaries. And I mean, this is part of the thesis of your book, correct?
Yeah, that's the beauty. That's why I'm never saying that language is the source of the intolerance. Because language, I think, can make you intolerant. You say people are black, people are white, people are homo, people are hetero. So language can serve intolerance, but the intolerance itself comes from other sources because there are languages that have more room, that have, mm-hmm. like she explains, that include a third gender or another category.
Talk about nature and nurture, and you talk about yourself as sort of your philosophy or your approach is interactionist.
Yeah.
That, I mean, we don't have to choose, correct?
Yeah, that's the thing, is that people want to choose. And so there are people who say men are from Mars and women are from Venus, and men are totally different in their brains and in their behavior from women. So there's this group. And then there's another group, let's say in the gender studies programs, where they sort of downplay all the differences and say, well, it's all socialization. Basically, men and women are very similar. Only between the legs is different. And those are the two extreme positions. And I'm a biologist and an interactionist. I believe that culture and biology always interact. You cannot take the one away from the other. You cannot say, for example, gender is independent from sex. I don't think that's a possibility. The gender and sex are always fused one way or another. So there's always an interaction between the cultural environment and your biology. You cannot tease them apart.
That was acclaimed biologist Franz de Waal discussing his book Different. He died last week at the age of 75. We're playing highlights from some of my Radio Times interviews with de Waal because he has so much to say about morality, culture, emotions, something that's at the heart of the connection. Coming up, are you smart enough to know how smart animals are?
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowain, and today in The Connection, we're playing highlights of some of the interviews I did with acclaimed biologist and author Franz de Waal, who died last week at the age of 75. He was always a fascinating and provocative guest to talk to. We spoke in 2016 about his book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? It's a good question. He joined us to talk about why humans have always underestimated animal intelligence and what us primates can learn from each other. We talked about his research involving problem-solving, tools, mirrors, memory, and identity.
Well, what do you mean by smart?
Well, smart relates to intelligence. So cognition is more like how you process information, and that's for each species quite different because, let's say, an echolocating bat has very different information than the one that you have. So the cognition of a bat is different. But intelligence and smartness has more to do with finding solutions in a flexible way to the problems that you face. And if you're good at that,
right,
then you're considered smart.
As problem solvers,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah.
I remember years ago interviewing a guy from Harvard University, actually Howard Gardner, and he talked about humans and our various kinds of intelligences. Mm-hmm. There's the sort of athletic intelligence, artistic, linguistic, people skills, things like that. Does that help us understand the kinds of intelligences that animals have?
Yeah, in a way.
Yes and no?
Yeah, so in that's within a species, but I'm, of course, more concerned with between species.
Yes.
Like, how do you compare an octopus and a bat and a chimpanzee and a human? And I think all of them have different kinds of cognitions, dependent on their senses and dependent on where they live and how they live. And it's very hard to compare them. Now, people compare them all the time, especially when it comes to humans, because they always want humans on the top. And to me, that's a sort of silly problem that I don't want to deal with. Is, are you smarter than an octopus? Is for me not an interesting question. Because
I'm not an octopus, right?
Yeah, you can read and write, and that's wonderful. And I don't think the octopus can do that. Even though if the octopus would write, it would write 8 books at the same time. Would be great. But for the octopus, that's not relevant. And the octopus has a totally different nervous system. It's spread out over the arms and everything. So why would I want to compare whether you're smarter or not? I could compare the cognition. I could say, what kind of cognition do you have versus the octopus? But this whole contest idea, like which one of the two is better, is a sort of silly question to me.
Is that an old question? I mean, I think, as I recall, even Darwin talked about, you know, the fact that we were sort of on the top of the pile when it came to evolution, intelligence, adaptation.
Well, I don't think Darwin would say that for evolution. But he fell for the Scala Naturae, which says that God is at the top, and then right under God comes the human. And so we're very proud of that. And then we go down the scale with fish and then mollusks and whatever. Worms at the bottom or whatever. And that scale has been a popular pastime of many people who have always compared up and down the scale. But the scale doesn't really exist. I consider all these species more like a bush and their specializations. It's a bush with many different specializations. And yes, humans are great at language, for example, which I consider a uniquely human characteristic. But we're not so great at some other stuff. For example, certain memory tasks that some animals are better at.
Well, in fact, talking about a memory task, you write about a chimpanzee, Ayumi. Am I pronouncing
Ayumo? Ayumo, I believe, yeah.
This chimpanzee who looks like has a photographic memory.
Mm-hmm.
What can Ayumi do?
So Ayumu can look at a computer screen on which 9 numbers appear and tap them in the right order. That by itself is already quite remarkable. And the numbers always appear in
meaning 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7?
Yeah, in the right order. And they always appear in different formats. But the interesting thing is that the numbers disappear within 200 milliseconds. That's like in the blink of an eye. So you barely get to see them. And then he has to tap the squares behind which the numbers are, so he cannot see the numbers anymore. And he can do that. And he has been tested against humans.
And done better?
Done much better. So a British memory champion was sent to Kyoto to compete with Ayumu and failed. The BBC was going to film it and broadcast it, but the guy was so embarrassed by it that he didn't permit them to put it on the internet. But Ayumu is better than people. And some psychologists have been very upset by that. I don't know why, because there's so many things that animals can do that are better than us. You know, you give a dog a smelling task, and of course he's going to beat us. So I don't know why they were so upset, but they went into training to see if they could do it, and they could do it with 5 numbers, but not with the 9.
Well, is it because we think, I mean, we created numbers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is our intelligence that Ayumu is moving in on.
Yeah, the 9 numbers is sort of irrelevant. I think you could have put other symbols there that he needs to. It's a serial task, basically. But he's now working on 15 numbers, and he clearly has a better flash memory, so to speak, than most people, or than all people, maybe.
Yeah. So is that adaptation for him to have this flash memory?
Well, we don't know what it is good for. We don't know.
So why can he do this?
Yeah, we don't know why he has that capacity. But for me, the interesting part was that people got upset by it because they always frame these things in terms of competition. Are we the smartest of them all? And we really aren't. And it's not even an interesting question, I think. The question we have certain specializations, especially when it comes to symbols and abstraction. We are very good at that. And why not leave it at that and say that we're good at that, but other animals are good at other things, you know?
I mentioned the word neo-creationism in my introduction, something that you write about in this book. What do you mean by that? And how does that help us understand what we're talking about?
Okay. Well, creationism is that you don't believe in evolution. You think the world was created 6,000 years ago or something like that. But neo-creationism So creationism you don't find much among academics, the general academics. But neo-creationism is very prevalent in philosophy, anthropology, psychology, and so on, outside of biology, basically, which basically assumes that, yes, we evolved, and all animals evolved, but evolution stops at the human head. The human head and brain and mind are different things and are not really comparable with, let's say, an animal mind. And that's a very common position. So people don't even want to make these comparisons. And as soon as you make a comparison with, let's say, chimpanzee intelligence, they say you're anthropomorphizing, you're not scientific, because, of course, a chimpanzee cannot reconcile or have empathy or whatever. So they try to create distance, whereas, of course, as a biologist, I'm trained as a biologist, we in biology and medicine and neuroscience, we think there's continuity everywhere.
Yeah. Well, this idea that evolution stops at the human head, I mean, evolution never stops, right? I mean, this is this constant evolving process. This is the world that we all live in.
But also everything we have has evolved. So the human brain, there's nothing in the human brain that is really new. The human brain is big. So it's three times bigger than a chimpanzee brain, and we can be very proud of that. But it's not a different brain. There are no parts in there. There's no neurotransmitters in there that other animals don't have. If you go back to the insects even, you will find neurotransmitters that are the same that we have. So there's an enormous continuity in brain. And that's why, for example, people will do studies on fear in rats to find solutions to human phobias, for example. So in neuroscience, we are very used to the continuity, and we assume that a rat brain operates in basically the same way as a human brain. So this whole story that the human brain and the mind are special, we don't necessarily believe in.
In the book, you talk about gratuitous
anthropomorphism.
Yes. Yeah, and gratuitous anthropomorphism.
Well, the bad anthropomorphism is if you overinterpret what an animal does or project your human feelings on them. So, for example, people go swimming with the dolphins, which I don't think is a good thing for the dolphins, but they do that at certain hotels. And they say, well, of course, the dolphins, they love it because look at all these smiley faces. Now the dolphin has no options. The dolphin has that face, and it may look smiley to us, but that doesn't mean they're happy about the whole thing. But people project their feelings on animals very easily. And we as scientists, we need to sort of stay away from that and be a little bit skeptical about certain things. But on the other hand, this enormous fear of anthropomorphism that we've seen in the last century, where everything you proposed about animals was immediately shut down by saying, well, you're being anthropomorphic. That is exaggerated, especially with animals as close to us as the apes. The apes are almost anthropomorphic by definition because the anthropoids, they're human-like. That's what that means. And so if you tickle an ape and he makes sounds like and he has a laughing expression on his face, that is laughing. They are laughing because they are like us and they have the same sort of responses. They kiss each other when they greet each other. They laugh when you tickle them and so on. And we need to use the same terminology for what they do.
In fact, you use that I'm having a hard time talking to a primatologist.
Anthropomorphism,
yeah, the denial part of that, which is sort of denying what's in front of our face. Right?
Yeah, I think the bigger problem in the previous century has been not anthropomorphism, but anthropodenial.
Right.
The bigger problem is people who wanted to keep animals at a distance and wanted to drive a wedge between them and us by stating that all animals are sort of instinct machines or stimulus response machines, and we are the only ones who can think. And as a result, they have created this distance, an artificial distance, and I call that anthropodenial, is that you deny the connection between you and your close relatives. And that applies certainly to the apes, but I would say it applies basically to all mammals, is that we should not be so scared of anthropomorphism.
But, you know, I'm thinking about how people are rethinking zoos and slaughterhouses and free-range chickens and Ringling Brothers basically taking their elephant acts out of the circus. SeaWorld is no longer going to be breeding orcas in captivity. Even chimps in research, there's some rethinking
of changed,
that.
Has changed
do you,
also.
Do you see that as progress on the part of human beings?
I think so. Of course, the implication of my kind of work, in this case on intelligence, is that animals are closer to us than we have often assumed. And I think that has moral implications, is that especially when it comes to animal suffering, I'm not necessarily concerned with let's say, the eating of animals, but certainly how we treat animals before we eat them, or how we treat animals in entertainment industry and so on. That's a big concern, and so we do need to address that.
But it seems to me it reflects an acknowledgement that these are intelligent animals, but also that they're feeling animals.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the videos that I've seen of elephants, for instance, and again, I don't know if I'm anthropomorphizing what I am seeing, but it looks like you see families and the kind of emotions that one would recognize in a family, the kind of caring devotion that we see, helping a baby elephant out of a hole or out of a ditch somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. So those are, let's say, the positive behaviors like empathy and helping and caring and attachment, which we see in many species, especially in mammals and birds. We see quite a bit of that. But the real issue is, do the animals suffer and how and when do they suffer? And can we reduce that? Is there a way for us to eliminate that? Or at least reduce it, and especially in the agricultural industry, which are really the big numbers. That's where the big numbers of animals, the circuses are small numbers compared with that. In that agricultural industry, the treatment of animals is horrific in my mind, and I think we need to start changing that. Of course, there is already an enormous push to do that. I think the push is sometimes a bit extreme in the sense that people say you need to go vegan. Well, that means that that 90% of the people is not going to follow you because they're not going to do that. And if you want to have 100% of the people behind you, which really should be your goal, you should go for a goal like improving conditions. Yeah.
Speaking of elephants, and you and some others have done some fascinating research using mirrors.
Yeah.
And a mirror, of course, raises all sorts of questions about when an elephant looks in a mirror, are they seeing themselves?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Walk us through that.
Yeah, so there are many animals who respond to their mirrors by total confusion. So there are certain small birds who keep attacking their mirror image, for example, and they never give up. There's other animals who learn to ignore. So your cats and dogs at home, they learn to ignore the mirror, basically. And there are a few animals, only a handful, who make the connection between their mirror image and themselves. Mm. And that's often called self-awareness, even though I think it's a bit black and white in the sense that I don't think a cat who doesn't recognize itself is not self-aware to some degree. But elephants and dolphins and the great apes and humans and the magpie. Those are the self-recognizing animals that we have at this moment, who you can test. You can put a mark on them. Let's say you put a mark on an elephant above its eye, something that he cannot see without a mirror, and you put him in front of a mirror, and he will start inspecting with his trunk that mark, because he connects his own face with his own body, basically.
Well, you mentioned something about cats and perhaps even dogs, that even if they don't look at themselves in the mirror, they are self-aware.
Well, they're not totally confused, as some fish and some birds are, who look at that mirror image as somebody else. So at least our pets, and that's why we can have mirrors in the home. Imagine that you had mirrors in the home and your dog would every day would keep attacking that mirror image. We wouldn't be happy with that. And so the fact that they learn to ignore that is a big step up already.
Well, it's interesting to think about a mirror and an animal recognizing themselves in a mirror and whether that says that they know who they are.
Oh, that's a big step.
It is a big step. I mean, can we make that step?
No, I feel that thing is absolute. So some scientists are like that. They say that the ones who recognize themselves in the mirror are self-aware, and all the rest is not self-aware. And I think that's much too absolute to say it that way. Because let's take when two dogs wrestle and in play, they will bite not their own legs or their own tails, they will bite those of the other. So they make a distinction between their own body and somebody else's body, which is already a form of self-awareness in my mind.
Right.
So I think all animals have some degree of self-awareness. They have to have that in order to act in the world, so to speak. But the mirror test taps into something that is bigger than that. And we don't know exactly what that is, but it's only the large brain, the largest brained animals who can do that kind of thing.
Which is as best we understand, them recognizing themselves in a mirror.
In human development, that's interesting. When children reach the point that they recognize themselves at about 2 years of age or a little bit younger, that's also the same time that they become very self-aware and they say, "Mommy, look at me." And so they become self-aware in that sense, and they start also to help others. They start to put themselves in the shoes of others and take their perspective. And the animals who recognize themselves, they have these same capacities. And so it is maybe special, and we don't know how it correlates to other things, but in human development it has an impact.
That was acclaimed primatologist, biologist, and author Franz de Waal from a 2016 interview on Radio Times. We were sad to learn he died last week at the age of 75. He had been a professor at Emory University and director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes National Primate Center for many, many years. He was also one of my favorite guests. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Connection. This program note, you can get a double helping of the show starting this Sunday. We are replaying The Connection at noon. So you can listen Fridays and Sundays at noon and wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Bilder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.